ESPN College Football Podcast.
Welcome, welcome to the ESPN College Football Podcast for Wednesday, May 11th. I'm Adam Rittenberg, joined by my friend, colleague, and Arizona hotel lobby stalker, fellow lobby stalker, Heather Dinich. We're here back from the meetings in Arizona last week, kind of clear of the NFL draft, and we're immersed in league meeting season. Last week, the Pac-12, Big 10, Big 12, Mountain West, some stragglers were all in Scottsdale talking about NIL and the transfer portal and a lot of big items around college athletics. This week, the ACC spring meetings are going on in Amelia Island, Florida. Our colleagues, David Hale and Andre Adelson, covering that really well for us at ESPN, and then SEC meetings coming up later this month. Other meetings are also taking place. But Heather, I know I saw you a lot last week. I see your face now. You're actually outside your property, so looks beautiful there in Maryland. But I guess you didn't get enough sun in Arizona. You wanted to be outside even more.
Well, we've got a little bit of demo construction things going on inside, so I figure our listeners would much rather hear the birds and the trees and the drills and the hammers. So, yeah, it's not quite as warm as Scottsdale here in Maryland, but I'll certainly survive.
The joys of home remodeling. We all know that feeling. Well, you and I were together for basically 4 days nonstop in Scottsdale. Before we get into how hard we work, can we just take a moment to appreciate the hard work of our colleagues, Matt Berry and Joey Galloway, who we saw in Arizona? I mean, God, you know, we were grinding, but they were at a different level, right, Heather? I mean, you know, they just put us to shame with their work ethic, didn't they?
I know. I wish Joey was here to defend himself, because I would definitely tease him about, I don't know, how many golf cart trips, how many laps he did through the lobby. Yeah, but they were, and Matt, of course, was right at home, literally, because he grew up right there. So, yeah, it was a little bit of a different experience for them. I felt like, you know, they were the cool kids in high school walking by, and we were just kind of sitting there at the other table banging on our computers.
pretty much. Yeah, it was a week of getting stuffed in our collective lockers, but we did have a lot of conversations. It was I think a very productive week of talking to commissioners and coaches and ADs and connecting with new people. First of all, what were kind of your biggest takeaways from that event? Because there were a lot of things discussed. I think there were a lot of hypotheticals and this might happen and where is this all going? And then there were some things that you could say, okay, I feel pretty good about this happening in this area, or this could happen in the next few years. How did you feel coming away from all those conversations that we had in the desert?
Well, I feel like the biggest answer anyone had, and everyone is searching for answers right now, is the transfer windows. And that was Todd Berry, the executive director of the Football Coaches Association. And he said that they're going to propose two transfer windows. The one being, I believe it's the last Sunday in November, to the early signing period that currently exists. And then the second being about mid-April to the May 1 deadline, which is really the only deadline that currently exists for the transfer portal. And every coach that I spoke to about that, and Todd talked about it, thought that that was a really positive first step in trying to help them say, okay, this is when you have to put your name in. But, you know, a detail that I feel like people aren't really talking about that, as it was explained to me, is even though you put your name in during that window, you can still transfer whenever you want, you know? So I kind of want to see it actually in play to determine how much it really does help coaches, and does it, if at all, help players decide where they want to go? Because you might want to go to one school because they have a great receiver, cough, cough, Pitt, and then that receiver might leave and you're across the country, Keaton Slovis. So, you know, I wonder how it all plays out. But that was a definitive, hey, here's an idea, let's implement it. We think it's going to help. And as far as everything going on in college football, that was the one thing that I heard that was concrete that I think is really going to happen.
Right. I think it was clear to both of us that even though NIL and the transfer portal are interconnected in many ways, one is under the control of the coaches and those in college athletics, and one very much is not, and that's NIL. And so the steps taken, not just with the proposed transfer windows, which, by the way, Todd Berry told us they proposed before the transfer portal even went into effect in 2018, but also flexibility around how you get to your 85 scholarships and not being tied to you can only sign 25 per year and then you can replace 7 who go into the portal, but basically get there however you can. That seems to make a lot of sense. I think it will benefit teams and coaches and provide a level of order to the portal. I am curious, to your point, Heather, how it affects the athletes and whether that will also benefit them to know, okay, this is the period where everyone will go in and I can sense, is this a good decision for me? Should I pull myself out? I can always re-enter at the end of April going into that May 1st deadline, which right now is the only deadline we have around the portal that you have to notify your initial school of your intention. I was talking to an athletic director yesterday about who's on the Football Oversight Committee about the need to also have a deadline for actual enrollment, when his point was, you know, you can commit to all these schools after you go into the portal, but until you sign, until something is binding, you're essentially being recruited right up until the season. So I do wonder if and that may be another committee, another area of the NCAA, but does there also have to be a deadline? May 15th, Heather, you have to enroll at this school, even though you just went into the portal a few weeks earlier. Otherwise, this will kind of continue right up until the season.
Well, and that's my point exactly, is that you put your name in. Okay, that's great. But how much does that really help if you don't have a window to say when you're going to actually pack your bags and move? And, you know, Adam, the more I think about this, the more I struggle with the impact of this on the intangible of what it takes to be a team. You think about the best teams in the country, and they have leadership, they have stability, they have a locker room that can't be broken. They have trust. I mean, when you have guys coming and going and you don't know who some of your best players are, and guys, it's a revolving door, how do you build that chemistry in the locker room, which takes sometimes the course of years to build? So you have new coaches, you have new players, and all of those things. I mean, everybody wants to go where you can win a national championship. I get that. So if you're Lincoln Riley and you're USC and you're building a national championship caliber roster, that's certainly possible. I get that. But that's different than other programs that are just trying to make it to the next level and really compete and win a conference championship or sustain what Pitt already has, right? Those are special years and special seasons. And I really do question the impact inside the locker room on all of the moves for players and leadership and how that impacts them and their ability to win.
Well, it's interesting. And I was talking to a few coaches about this and others who we saw last week about how the attitudes among players seem to have changed. There was a time where the thought of an established player transferring would have led to backlash in the locker room. I don't know if it really does. We've had players transfer from LSU to Alabama. You've had players transfer, within conferences on a regular basis. And it feels, at least not being in those locker rooms, that those are greeted mostly positively in the locker room, because it's like, okay, go do what you need to do. It's not, man, you're abandoning us. And maybe more of that said behind the scenes. I know there was a bit of a backlash when Jaden Daniels, the Arizona State quarterback, went into the portal so late. And now he ends up at a LSU competing for that job. But it feels like most of the players are okay with this, which is, it's surprising to me, because especially when it's in a conference, within the conference or to a rival, I know if I was on a team, I'd be pretty upset if that was the case. But I guess we're just in a new era with NIL and the mobility that these players now enjoy.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think it'll take, honestly, a couple of years to figure out. And I mean, really just scratch the surface of this NIL. 5 years from now, what are the stories that come out of it. I mean, there's going to be a lot more people who lose a lot more, I think, in many ways than people who gain. You know, we have tunnel vision of the players who are big time starters and getting the mad cash waved in front of them and first team, all this and that. But that's not the majority. You know, there are literally hundreds of other college athletes out there who are experiencing something different right now.
Before we move on, a couple things we need to mention. First, the final episode of Man in the Arena is now available to stream on ESPN Plus, along with the entire series. It's Tom Brady like you've never seen him before. Stream it now on ESPN Plus. Man in the Arena is presented by Under Armour. And listen to First Take, Her Take. Elle Duncan, Kimberly A. Martin, and Charlie Arnold give you a peek into their lives as they navigate their careers and relationships while giving their unfiltered opinions on the sports world's hottest topics. Listen to First Take, Her Take wherever you find your podcasts. Well, let's get into NIL because it was undoubtedly the biggest topic in our conversations in Arizona. It's continued this week as the NCAA put out, you know, kind of a reminder of its guidelines about what NIL was intended to be and then what it's turned into with the collectives and, you know, some of the inducements that are going on for recruits and for transfers. You know, George Kliavkoff, the Pac-12 commissioner, Greg Sankey, the SEC commissioner, went to Washington on Thursday to meet with senators and try to drum up some support around federal NIL legislation, and then also remind them of what they call the existential threat of athletes becoming employees. And you know, we talked to George, and he laid out an argument about why that could be challenging for schools. There's people on the other side that say it won't be that challenging, and it may be beneficial going forward to have a very clear relationship, an employer relationship. What were your biggest thoughts and takeaways from just all those conversations around NIL, and where do you think this is going now in the immediate?
Well, I think my reaction to the NCAA, I know my reaction, I should say, to the NCAA's guidelines is, well, okay, great. When you enforce it, that's when people will start paying attention to it. And I think a lot of the people we spoke to in Scottsdale have doubts that it will be enforced. Now, Kliavkoff in the Pac-12 told you and I on the record that if the NCAA doesn't enforce it, his league will do it themselves. And I think that's interesting too. And do other conferences follow them in that regard? And what specifically do they do in order to hold those people accountable? Because as Dave Clawson at Wake Forest pointed out, this is third party stuff. This is why it's always been a problem, because it's not necessarily the player or the coach. It's somebody else who's interfering in it. And NIL has exacerbated that, right? So you have that aspect to it. And then if you are going to punish a player from going from one school to the other or whatever, that gets dicey. I'm telling you, I haven't been in one meeting where commissioners have been at where there hasn't been an attorney present. Not one, right? And so I do think that this shows that the NCAA, which has been afraid of legal repercussions, is getting a little bolder and realizing you have to take some legal risks in order to curtail the things that are going on right now. Now, that being said, Adam, the fact that Greg Sankey and George Kliavkoff went to Washington, D.C., and not outgoing NCAA President Mark Emmer or anyone from the NCAA, I mean, that to me says more about where college athletics is than anything right now. Because we all knew that they weren't going to walk out of Washington, D.C. with a law that's going to change this. This was symbolic conversations to get things started, right? But at the same time, that was the first real assertion of leadership at the collegiate level to say, help us, okay? Somebody help us, because we can't do this ourselves. And the fact that it wasn't somebody from Indianapolis doing that, to me, shows where all this is headed.
Right. I think it was definitely significant, but maybe more so symbolic of what's changing, because to me, and we'll get into this later in the podcast, I think the biggest takeaway is that the Power Five is ready to break away and do their own deal. But I kind of in that same vein, I think that these people, George Kliavkov, Greg Sankey, Kevin Warren, Jim Phillips, and then whoever replaces Bob Bowlsby, are the most important people in college athletics. And it's not Mark Emmert because he's been deemed an ineffective leader. And I don't need to say that. You don't need to say that. Let's hear from Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn, who was one of the senators that Sankey and Kliavkov met with on Thursday. She released a statement. I'll read here in part. For far too long, the NCAA has refused to allow student athletes to benefit from the use of their name, image, and likeness. NCAA President Mark Emmert's resignation is one of many necessary structural changes that will enable the NCAA to support our student athletes. And then I obviously talked about the meeting with Sankey. So she just names it right there. That with Emmert gone, maybe they can discuss this in a different way and maybe come to some level of consensus. Now, Big 12 Commissioner Bob Bowlsby, you know, talked with myself and Ralph Russo from the AP briefly and said, hey, don't hold your breath. You know, we've all had these meetings. We've all reached out to people in Washington. Nothing is going to happen before the midterm elections in November. So that probably means early 2023 at the earliest. So What can we take away from what happened last Thursday and the comment from Senator Blackburn of Tennessee? You know, we know that George Kliavkov has a previous connection to Senator Cantwell of Washington. So this is not just one side of the aisle is trying to get bipartisan support. But to Bowlsby's comment, I think he's right. Nothing is likely to happen soon there.
Right. And I don't think that they expected it to when they went to Washington, D.C. I think to get those conversations going and headed in the right direction is a step that they felt like they needed to take. Obviously, Kliavkov, because he took a red eye from Scottsdale to get there, you know? So, you know, it's important, but I do agree with Bowlsby that it's not going to happen immediately. But look, that's the other big takeaway for me from all these spring meetings. And David Hale wrote about it yesterday. There's a lot of response being, hey, get used to it. This is it. This is the world we live in right now. And while I think, yes, that's true, they have to assert more leadership to curtail the way it's happening right now. I mean, do coaches make a gazillion dollars and have to get used to what's going on? Yeah, to a certain extent. But I mean, again, we go back to the windows. You just can't. How do you put a team together if you're going to have your starting quarterback leave you before summer camp? If you're a fan, of team, insert team here, you want to know who's on your roster. I can't tell you how many people I saw on Scottsdale. I said, man, I wish you guys would just start playing football so I know who's on your team.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm trying to think about how it matches up with the NFL, because the NFL does have a designated period of free agency. There are some moves that take place shortly before the season kicks off, but for the most part, you have the draft, you have free agency, and you kind of know what your team is by May or June going into that coming season. Whereas in college football, there will be moves that are going to be made all the way up, you know, to and maybe through August, which are worth watching. And so I think again, if we're in this era, I completely agree with what Mike Bray told David Hale and other reporters in Florida yesterday, that coaches have to stop complaining. We make good money. So everybody should shut up and adjust. I completely agree with that. I think some of the coaches we spoke to in Arizona feel the same way, but without any order around the transactional nature, increasingly transactional nature in college football, it's going to be a real challenge. You know, I think the NIL discussion, I'm wondering sort of what happens next. You talked about what George Kliavkov told us and his message to their coaches in the Pac-12, essentially, hey, if the NCAA doesn't do anything, I'm going to step in and I'm not going to punish the athletes for the most part. I'm going to punish you guys and I'm going to punish the teams. You know, that's obviously a warning shot. How equipped is he in your mind to actually follow through on that? Because we've seen the difficulty from the NCAA in collecting enough evidence to pursue a real case against a lot of these schools. And even when they do have evidence, like in the basketball scandal, it's taking years and years and years. So how much faith do you have in George K and his league and his process to actually respond when there's issues that crop up in the Pac-12?
Well, he's a smart dude. Let me tell you, he is sharp. And I think that if he can figure out how to collect said evidence, I don't doubt for a minute that he'll stay true to his word and hold somebody as an example, especially right off the bat. The problem, like you said, and that we've talked about, is that so much of this is not the coach. So much of this is third party. Man, how about the receiver at Boston College? His name is escaping me right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yeah. But Thamel wrote about him. Hathaway didn't even know until he came to him and told him, you know? So you've got these other people who are working the ears of these players. And unless the player comes to the coach and says, hey man, so-and-so reached out to me about the possibility of $600,000. What do you do? You know, I mean, Jeff at BC is lucky that he came to him and they were able to have an honest conversation about it. That's not always how it goes. The coach is sometimes blindsided by this. So I think it's a case by case thing as to how it plays out and who really knows what and when. That stuff's hard to track down.
Yeah, it is. And I think where most people in college athletics are right now, at least on the non-player side, is you go ahead and make as much money as you can at your school because of what you've created there. What we don't want is you moving to other schools based on the inducement of what you could make, whether it's a recruit or whether it's a transfer. And my sense with the Jordan Addison thing, and I want to hear your thoughts, Heather, is why it bothers people so much is because it's hard for them to wrap their mind around the reasoning for his move. Yeah, sure, there's a monetary reason for him to go to USC or to go to Texas or wherever he ends up. He visited Texas on Monday, where his former receiver coach ended up from Pitt, Brennan Marion. But this is a guy who's won a national award. He's won a conference title. He's projected as a first round pick. He's at a Power 5 school. He's in a big city. So, you know, it's harder to sort of be okay with this move, it seems like, for people versus a group of five player who's moving up or a player that's going home to be closer to family if there's some type of family situation. This one is just not sitting well, especially with the, you know, rumors that he had been reached out to by representatives of other schools. What were some of your thoughts just from your conversations with people in Arizona? Because this came up in meetings, this came up privately at the bars and the patio and the pool as well. This Jordan Addison situation as sort of one that that could be a preview of the future in NIL.
Well, certainly athletic directors are concerned about it. And, you know, Martin Jarman at UCLA talked to me on the record and said something along the lines of, as you know, it's not a very friendly environment right now. But he said, we have to talk about it. And they did, you know, behind closed doors. There are conversations going on about it. But look, as I'm sitting here, I have a very hard time faulting a kid for whatever choice he makes, especially when I don't know the particulars of who is in his ear exactly, because that could be some very powerful people. When you're however old he is and you've got money offers dangling in front of you, you know, I don't know. I can't get inside his head or blame him for a decision that he's making. That has to be personal. I think, again, it goes back to the issues around him that have to be regulated so he's not put in that position at that time. So his team's not put in that position. There has to be a better way, a right way to go about it, to allow these kids the opportunity to play where they want to play, get paid the proper way for what it is intended, their name, image, and likeness, without all that. But it's certainly bothering people.
Yeah, it is. And I wanted to come out of the meetings last week with at least some answers or some things I thought were definitely going to happen. And, you know, you wrote a piece early in the week talking to Ohio State Athletic Director Gene Smith, where he just came out and said, you know, the Power Five needs to operate, or the football playing schools in the FBS need to operate within the context of the CFP, because we can't exist and govern ourselves and get things done and change policy with the current setup of the NCAA. You know, we had those conversations as well with commissioners and other ADs and coaches. And that was the one thing I came out of the meeting saying, I can't see any way that the Power Five stays in the current governance structure, that they don't break away at some point. But on Monday, there was news out of the ACC meetings. Mike Bray, the Notre Dame basketball coach, saying that ACC Commissioner Jim Phillips had assured him that the Power Five is not breaking away, at least not anytime soon. So what do you think is going to happen there? Because we had a lot of compelling arguments, both on and off the record, with people in Arizona laying out why this needs to happen. But maybe it doesn't happen in the immediate future.
Well, for one, when Jim Phillips talks about it, I would certainly lean in and listen a little bit closer, because he's on the transformation committee. He was on the committee to rewrite the governance. So he's plugged in and in tune from that aspect. But that being said, there is a weariness amongst the FBS level of trying to pretend that those 10 leagues are anywhere in the same conversation as the rest of, quote, Division One, right? It's silly to treat them the same way, what they're saying, when you've got an obscenely difference in budgets, right? Look, just stop pretending that Alabama, Ohio State, and Clemson are in the same conversation as about 800 other schools out there, whatever it is, right? The NCAA is made up of about 1,200 schools, right? So that what they're trying to say is we operate differently. We have a different budget. Stop pretending that college football isn't the driving force that it is, and let's create new rules under this umbrella of the 10 FBS conferences, not just Power Five. What Gene Smith was saying, his line of demarcation was 85 scholarships. The programs that can invest in 85 football scholarships are different from everybody else. So let's act like that and treat it that way. Now, that being said, and you and I talked about this, Adam, I have a hard time believing that athletic directors just dismiss every other sport and Olympic sports and everything else just falls by the wayside. I don't believe that that's happening. So the NCAA, I think there's still a desire for them to host championships for the Olympic sports, for men's and women's basketball. But I think the reality is that college football to operate under that umbrella, I think that's where the separation, that's where they want it to be, right? If you could sort of draw a line in the sand, it's who operates under college football the way you can get into the college football playoff. Then again, Gene also said that the CFP could operate like the FCS and just have a real college football playoff, just like the FCS does. And I don't know how seriously that would ever get consideration.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, everyone's asking, well, the NCAA is going to be weakened in the future. I think the NCAA can still have a function, especially in those other sports, and in terms of providing opportunities and putting on great championships. But like you said, the problems with the top football playing schools are very much exclusive to them. And for them to sit on a committee with people who don't really look like them, not actually, but like just in terms of what they're dealing with, I can sense that frustration. I totally get that. And why I think that we are headed towards at least something different in the coming years. You mentioned revenue and I just laugh at that, because it felt like of all the stories that seemed to go under the radar last week in Scottsdale, because of the NIL conversation, because of the transfer conversation, some of these anecdotal things going on, like Jordan Addison. By the way, the Big Ten is on the cusp of putting together a $1 billion media rights agreement, most likely, maybe even north of $1 billion. And you and I spoke with Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren, who didn't throw out those exact numbers, but was somewhat specific in terms of laying out the timeline for when this could come together. And he said that the initial parameters of an agreement likely will be in place by late May or early June. The Big Ten board, which is all the presidents and chancellors, meets the first weekend of June. And the Big Ten has talked to, obviously, Fox, its anchor partner, ESPN, CBS, NBC, Turner, but also Apple and Amazon, and they are poised to put together a media rights agreement that I think will, you know, kind of set the course for the next few of these around college athletics. The Pac-12 has theirs coming up, the Big 12 as well. So what was your sense in talking to Kevin about how this has come together and what it could mean for the Big Ten schools, but also for those on the outside that might have deals coming up, or in the ACC's case, doesn't have a deal coming up, and how that could impact them?
Well, Kevin didn't say this, but I will. When the Big Ten gets this TV deal done, which is going to be historic and blockbuster, the Big Ten and the SEC are just going to suck the air right out of everybody else. They're going to be head and shoulders above the rest because of OU and Texas eventually making the SEC the 16-team super conference. It's going to make a great conference, the 600-pound gorilla, right? So I think those two things, it'll be interesting to see how everybody follows that. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the Big 12. I mean, look, the reality of the situation is that once OU and Texas leave, to me, I look at that as an upgraded American Athletic Conference. And with all due respect to what they did, they did the best they could at the time with the information available. I feel like that's what I said about my family through the entire 2020 pandemic. We did the best we could with the information we had at the time. Now everybody move on, right? So the Big 12 did the same thing. I don't fault them for anything they did, but those four schools are not half of OU and Texas and what they bring to that league. So you couple the Big Ten's blockbuster TV deal with the SEC becoming what it is, the Pac-12 at least has a chance to negotiate and reinvent itself with its media rights deal. So then what? Man, like you said, ACC's locked into like 2035. So I'll tell you what. So if I'm on the outside looking in at the Big Ten and their schools are going to make like, I don't know, buku bucks, $80 million a year per school, $100 million, whatever it's going to turn out to be. I don't know about you, but Adam, I want a piece of that pie. I'm joining my hand. How can I join the Big Ten, right? So to me, I think it's going to be really interesting. And that's just reality. Nobody has said that to me. Hey, I want to join the Big Ten. I'm just telling you, that's what happens, right? So I sat there with Shane Lyons, the athletic director at West Virginia, and he said, everybody's asking me if this is it for realignment. And he's like, you know, I think everything's kind of quiet. I said, Shane, I'm going into my 15th season at ESPN. And if there's one thing that I've learned, it is never over. It's never over. It's always something. Who the hell saw OU Texas coming? Not me. So I just think those TV deals getting done are going to open up a whole other door to maybe more playoff expansion conversation, maybe more realignment conversation, just a whole other reevaluation of where college football is and who's winning and owning what.
And this is what's driving the conversation around super leagues, which I've had a hard time really wrapping my head around, but you're going to have two conferences that are, again, making so much more money per school than everybody else. And to your point, you're going to absolutely have other schools that are going to want to enter those conferences. Now, the question is, do those conferences want to add more members? I don't know if it's that simple. I don't know if we're going to have, you know, kind of 30 schools that are making way more money than everybody else. And some members of the existing Big Ten and SEC who are left on the wayside. I can't see that happening. So I know someone very prominent in college athletics just told us that he thinks it's nonsense, the Super League talk and discussion. Where do you think that's headed? Because that's certainly going to come up as soon as this Big Ten deal will come through. And also, how will the Big Ten money impact the NIL conversations? Because it's a harder and harder argument for those in college athletics to make around student athlete employment or just complete freedom around NIL when the Big Ten is going to be pocketing this huge media deal coming up in the next few months.
Well, the one thing that I have heard, I should say one of the things I have heard athletic directors and commissioners vehemently agree on is no pay for play. Nope. don't want it. Don't want it. NIL is as far as we're going to go, but we're not paying our athletes. We're not turning this into a semi-pro. And by the way, when you turn it into a semi-pro, what happens? They don't get to pick where they go to school. I'm paying you. Oh, this is going to be a draft. Guess who I'm taking in the first round, right? So all of a sudden, they're not picking their schools. They're going where they're told to go to get paid to go there, right? So I think there are 1,000 different ways that you can look at it. But I go back to the reason athletic directors do what they do is not just for college football players. It's for the tennis players, the lacrosse players, the swimmers. I mean, you name it. I mean, how big is baseball at some of these schools? I've been to a doubleheader at a super regional at LSU. Holy cow. You know, like, I mean, McGee will tell us about the College World Series. It's just, there are other sports. And when you talk about semi-pro, we're all talking about football, right? We're all talking about football, maybe hoops, but I just think that I'm kind of in, I believe it when I see it mode with the whole semi-pro type deal.
No, I'm with you too. And again, there's strong arguments on both sides, and you know, that's why there's important meetings going on in Washington, and it will be a lot of changes this summer. This will be a very interesting next 2-3 months, not anything on the field, but media agreements and NIL and what people are saying. We'll have a new Big 12 commissioner most likely. When you were talking about the Big 12, I was kind of smiling, Heather, because I think that's why we saw such a big smile on Bob Bowlsby's face and how relaxed he was, because he knows that in a few months he's not going to be dealing with any of this, and his replacement will. And it'll certainly be interesting to see how that plays out. There was a little bit of football news I want to get to here as we start to wrap up the pod involving quarterbacks. Emory Jones, the former Florida quarterback, he's headed to Arizona State to play for Herm Edwards next year. Had started at Florida for the Gators. Now will be joining the Sun Devils, who are looking to replace Jaden Daniels. Former Baylor quarterback Gary Bohannon, he's headed to South Florida to play for Jeff Scott and the Bulls. So that's an interesting pickup. A guy who has started in the Big 12, helped Baylor to a Big 12 championship game, but lost his starting job this spring. So Bohannon is headed to South Florida, whereas Jones is headed to Arizona State. As we're doing every week throughout the off season here on the pod, we are every episode is sponsored by a letter as we get closer to that preseason lead up. And today's episode is brought to you by the letter M, Heather, which covers quite a lot of teams in college football, including a number of notable Power Fives. I'll go through the full list here: Marshall, Maryland, Memphis, Miami, Florida, Miami of Ohio, Michigan, Michigan State, Middle Tennessee, Minnesota, Mississippi State, and Missouri. I wanted to ask you about Michigan, though. You and I were both surprised and somewhat delighted to see Jim Harbaugh and his wife, Sarah. Jim typically is not there at these meetings in Arizona, but he was not just there. He was there all week. And so it was interesting to see him making his way around the property. He seemed relaxed, having a good time. Coaches told me he was very active in the Big Ten meetings. And you know, this is a guy that seemed like he was out the door to the NFL just a few months ago. Now he has said, I'm not entertaining any more offers. I'm at Michigan. I'm a Michigan man. I'm going to coach the rest of my career at my alma mater, coming off of a Big Ten championship and a college football playoff appearance. One of his offensive coordinators, Sharon Moore, I saw him as well at the Fiesta Bowl one of their developmental programs on Friday. What just in general, what do you think of where Michigan is at right now, and Harbaugh after a huge season last year, kind of a strange winter, but now he's seemingly all in with being the Michigan coach and trying to get this team to the next level?
I'm excited. Can we have Ohio State, Michigan now?
Yeah.
'Cause that's what it all comes down to, right? And I think what everyone has told me about Harbaugh that I've talked to has said he has this uncanny ability to laser focus on the task at hand. So while he had that Super Bowl thing going on in his head, when that was over, switch flipped back to Michigan, right? Now, how was that received? Apparently, I guess it was okay because they're moving on. They did spring ball and everybody's kind of turned the page on that and put it behind them. But what he said at that press conference, the first time he spoke publicly afterwards, when he described his team this year as scary good, I thought that was very bold and telling, for him to say what his belief was in the team at this time. And I think they have a great chance to do it again. They know what it takes to get there. But again, it all boils down to the game. But they were able to do that again too. So I personally am a big believer in Ohio State this year. And it started for me watching the Rose Bowl. And I thought, man, that was a fantastic football game that was so fun to watch because Utah just played its guts out. And then you look at Ohio State and how many players they were down. And I thought, man, they're doing with this without who? And they're still doing this? And who's coming back next year? I mean, they're going to be just fine. But I think that's what it's going to boil down to again. Now, we can't forget Michigan State. I understand that. But I think Mel Tucker is doing a good job. I just think Ohio State and Michigan are a few steps ahead right now.
Yeah, it's going to be a big year for Michigan to kind of remain ahead of the curve because they took a massive step forward last year, but they do lose a lot, especially on the defensive side with Aiden Hutchinson, the number two overall pick, moving on to the NFL, Dax Hill, another first-round pick at safety, and then David Ojabo, who would have been a first-round pick, their other defensive end, going in the second round to the Baltimore Ravens, and John Harbaugh and Mike McDonald, the former defensive coordinator, drafting Ojabo, who tore his Achilles, unfortunately, on pro day. So I'm curious to see if that defense, under a new coordinator and Jesse Winker, can they maintain what we saw for much of last season? And then ultimately, can they get more from the quarterback position? I think Cade McNamara has been really solid for them, but I think there's a feeling watching JJ McCarthy that he's that next level guy. He's just got a little bit higher ceiling. But again, he was out for pretty much the whole spring. So very interesting quarterback situation at Michigan as they prepare for the 2022 season and the Big Ten title defense, which includes a trip to Columbus in late November. Also, Heather, wanted to ask you about Miami. I think they're one of the most interesting teams in the country this year and really for the next few seasons with Mario Cristobal taking over at his alma mater in Miami. Finally spending money. And our colleague Andrea Adelson did a great piece about this recently on ESPN.com, detailing the investment to get Mario Cristobal, to get Dan Radakovich as the athletic director, to put money into NIL and to facilities. And Mario Cristobal was very Miami-like in what he said to Andrea, saying that, hey, we have dominated this sport once and we haven't invested like we need to, and you haven't seen a fully bought in Miami for a long time, and we're going to be able to do this again. How confident do you think, or how correct, I should say, do you think Mario is in those comments, and what can we expect out of them in year one with him as the coach? Tyler Van Dyke is back. They have some other dynamic players on both sides of the ball, but they have not been able to reach that next level in what we would both agree has been a winnable ACC. So can they do it this year?
They can, because the ACC Coastal Division is always a coin toss, right? I mean, anyone can win it. I don't care who you are. But that being said, I think truly getting Miami back to the elite level is still a couple years away. But they're doing exactly what they need to do. So to answer your question, yes, I think he is right. You can 100% win national championships at Miami. There is no reason for Miami or Florida or Florida State to not be loaded with talent just go to Pahokee, right? I mean, there's enough for everybody right there. So you take that plus the investment. That's the key component that Miami has been missing, is the financial backing that they need to hire the best coaches, to apparently invest in name, image, and likeness, right? And help out with all of those things. But there's no reason for Miami to not at some point return to the elite, I guess, of college football is the best way to say it.
Yeah, I'm just, this is going to be so much fun to watch here in the next few years, because you've been to Miami. I've heard a lot about Miami and their lack of investment, and I think they are finally doing what they need to compete and try to get back to the national stage. Real quick, Heather, wanted to get your thoughts on three, I think, under the radar, a little bit M teams that could be real factors this year. Two are in the Big Ten. One is in the SEC. Talking about Maryland, coming off of a successful season, they bring back Talia Tungavailoa, really good receiving corps. Pretty much their entire offense returns intact. Minnesota, they've been a program on the rise in the Big Ten West. They're starting to beat Wisconsin. They haven't won a division yet, but they bring back Tanner Morgan. Their offensive coordinator, Kirk Chiraka, who had been there when they won 11 games in 2019. So Minnesota's intriguing to me. And then Mississippi State is really my sleeper in the SEC with Will Rogers coming back off of a record-setting season, that Mike Leach offense. They got receivers. They're going to be a real tough team to beat in the SEC West, even though most of the focus will be on Alabama and on Texas A&M. So with those three teams, who do you like the most to really make some noise this year in the Big Ten or the SEC?
Arkansas.
Not an M team.
All right, listen. So Maryland, I'm coming to you live from Maryland. I was down in College Park last week, and I have to tell you, I was in their new football facility. It's been way too long since I've been in there. Unbelievable. I mean, I've been to Maryland many, many, many times, and that's the first time I've walked into one of their facilities and gone, wow. Okay, so you're playing catch up. You're investing too. That's a big deal. They're still stuck in the Big Ten East. If Maryland can play more competitive games, then you start to see progress. Maryland's getting blown out of games. I went to College Park last year, Friday night, watched them play Iowa. Stop, just stop. So I'm not talking about Maryland until they stop playing games like that. So Minnesota, I understand what you're saying, but Wisconsin and Iowa, to me, are still ahead of those two. And I'm very torn as to which one is better, honestly, this year, Wisconsin or Iowa. I think Wisconsin has a bit of an edge, but to me, that would be my pick there. And I know you like Mississippi State. I keep reading these things that you write in our roundtables about Mississippi State. I'm not buying it. I am seriously, as the sleeper in the SEC, I'm going with Arkansas. I like what Sam Pittman has done. KJ Jefferson, I think, is a great quarterback. They have a lot of pieces in place. I think that they took a major step in learning what they can do last year. And I don't know if you want to call them Markansas so we can fit in here, go ahead. But that I'm going to dissent on your Mississippi State pick.
Follow the rules, Heather. No, it's okay. Arkansas has done a great job. Sam Pittman, we saw him out in Arizona briefly, and he's blown me away in terms of my expectations when they hired him. But anyway, that is going to do it for this week's edition of the ESPN College Football Podcast. We've talked a lot of big topics. We did get into some football. I can't wait to do more of that as we get closer to the season. Next week's episode will be brought to you by the letter N. Heather Dinich, you're the best. You survived with me a week in Arizona, and you still were willing to do this with me today. So I appreciate you. Obviously appreciate Taylor and Sarah. And we'll be back next week on the ESPN College Football Podcast. Thanks so much for downloading us.